Okay, so in our previous learning, we talked about the rooster and the hen. And that led us into a discussion of Bar Dreima, Har HaMelech, the whole discussion of what happened there. Another statement was made early in the Gemara, where Rabbi Yochanan talks about, the Gemara says that the reason that the destruction of Beitar, not the second Beis HaMikdash, but the destruction of Beitar, which as I mentioned at the outset of the previous class, also took place on Tisha B'Av with disastrous consequences and Jewish bodies that were left unburied for many years. And then later, the miracle of their bodies not decomposing, and because of this we have the fourth blessing of Birchat HaMazon. And of course, you might ask yourself, you know, thanks a lot for that miracle, but like for this we have to make an extra blessing on Birchat HaMazon because bodies didn't decompose. Why couldn't we have like a miracle of being saved? And why did that miracle of all miracles stay with us? And one of the explanations is that when the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, and then we had this tremendous hope Mashiach would come soon, and you know, the first Galut was 70 years, and here we were 70 years later and fighting, and the greatest of the great, the Rebbe of the day, Rabbi Akiva, believed this is it. And the Rambam tells us he wasn't wrong. He wasn't wrong in thinking this could have been it, because it could have been it. This is the signs of the Mashiach. Unfortunately, it wasn't to be. And then after the crushing defeat of Beitar, and the murder of millions and millions of Jews, and the waste of Eretz Yisrael, laid to waste entirely, desolate, ruined for centuries afterwards. So many Jewish people thought, now it's really over. You know, the Romans, after destroying the second Beis HaMikdash, they put up their Arc de Triomphe, and they wrote, Judea Capta. The Jews are gone, the Jews are vanquished. But we weren't gone. And they renamed Yerushalayim, Elias Capitolina, and they forbade Jews from entering the city, and they sought to denigrate us, and demoralize us, and demotivate us to the point that we would no longer be able to function, and we'd never bounce back. But we did, Baruch Hashem, we did. And then after the second defeat, it was just so bitter, so bad, that there were people literally became so despondent that they just gave up. Just gave up. You know what? It's over. We'll never rebuild. We'll never bounce back. We'll never, ever, ever have a future. And then when these bodies suddenly showed up all those years, or 14 years later, and they were not decomposed, what was the message? The message was, yeah, it's terrible times. It's awful. It's horrible. Millions of funerals had to be held, but Hashem is still with us. In the darkness, in the pain, in the trials and travails, even there, the Eibishter was still there. We still were a miraculous people. And that's HaToiv HaMeitiv. It's not HaToiv, it's HaToiv HaMeitiv. So now we're going to talk about what led to that destruction, which in some ways was as crushing for the nation of Israel, almost as the Tisha B'Av that had preceded 70 years earlier. The Gemara says, Ashaka the Rispak Chorev Beitar. That Beitar was destroyed because of a wagon door. Was this a female kind of wagon, a female carriage. And a female carriage, because something went wrong with a door, that's how the city of Beitar was destroyed. But remember, the city of Beitar was not just a city, it wasn't just a geography. This represented the possibility of reconstitution, of redemption, and those hopes were dashed with, as I said, devastatingly demoralizing consequences. So this is the story. The Gemara says, the Havi Nehiga, it was the custom of the people of Beitar, Kavi Misyala Yanuka, that when a child would be born, a Yanuka is a male child, Shosle Arza, they would plant a cedar tree. So today when a Jewish baby gets born, he gets certificates in the mail that trees were planted for him in Israel. Then they actually planted a tree. They planted a tree. The family, they were living in Israel. There was no JNF that was raising money from Canadian Jews to plant forests in Israel. Jews in Israel, planting trees, plain and simple. Why they plant a tree? And then, if a baby girl was born, Yanukta, it's a baby girl, Shosli Tarnita, they used to plant a different kind of Erez tree, a like a female Erez tree, which is called Shittim, Acacia, a different kind of cedar tree. The male tree, the male version of the female version. Okay. So why did they plant specifically a cedar tree? And they planted a male cedar and a female cedar. So one of the reasons is, the Ion Yaakov says, that the cedar tree was in times of antiquity for Jewish people symbolic of strength, of beauty, and of durability. Where do we see this? Because David HaMelech says in the 92nd Psalm, Ki erez balvonoi nizge, right? That the righteous will tower like the Lebanon cedars. By the way, Lebanon was not a country. Lebanon was an area, a geography. A significant portion of what the world today calls Lebanon, Levanon, is northern Eretz Yisrael. So the cedars of Eretz Yisrael, in the northern part of Eretz Yisrael, which were known as Levanon, that was the symbol, the sign of something beautiful, beautiful vegetation, stately, dignified vegetation. So therefore, when the Jewish people wanted to plant a tree that would be propitious, that would be kind of emphasizing the future of the child, what they hope for the child, so what would they do? They would plant such a tree like we say, Tzadik HaTomer Yifrach, Ke'eres Bavonin Yizge. He'll be like a, he'll give fruit like a tomer, but he'll stand tall like an Erez tree, a cedar tree. So that's what everybody wanted for the children. And there's many other reasons. So this is how the story begins. The story begins, first you have to have a little bit of background. The background is, this was the custom of the day, this is what Jewish people did. Yoim Echad, it so happened, one day, Kocholfa Brate de Kesar, the daughter of the Caesar, was passing through. Now we know that there's an emphasis here, that the Gemara tells the story about the daughter of the Caesar. It doesn't say the cousin of the Caesar, it doesn't say the son of the Caesar. Not that the son of the Caesar would necessarily have become the Caesar after. Anyway, because the custom in Rome was that you would adopt a son, you would become Caesar based on ability, not birthrights, not genetics. The first one ever to have implanted his own son in the position of being Caesar was Marcus Aurelius Antoninus, and by the way, we had disastrous results. That was the beginning of what we call today nepotism. Nepotism is when you put a person who's not capable of being in a position. So the Romans were very, very worried about nepotism, even though from a Torah perspective, there is such a concept of Yerusha. And as long as somebody, if he doesn't have the capability, at least he has reverence. If he has reverence, if he reveres Hashem properly, as Yerushalayim, he'll figure out to hire right people to do the job. You know, you can hire advisors. But then in Rome, they wanted to rule out nepotism, so until Marcus Aurelius, there was every Caesar, at some point they would be like the patron. They would find a young person who they believed in, and they would take this young guy, and that's it. They would adopt him. Sometimes they would arrange him a marriage, and they would mentor him. And there was always what we call continuity. Always created continuity. So the son was not necessarily going to be the replacement of his father, but the Gemara emphasizes furthermore, not only it doesn't, it's about the daughter, because the Gemara wants us to know that the daughter has a special relationship with the father. You ever hear the expression, daddy's little girl? So it says the bat shayach, the bat is more connected to the father. Where do we see this? We see the father as being a protector of his daughter in the end of Chumash Bamidbar, Parshas Matos. What does it say? Bina ureha beisavia. That the Torah gives the father the right and the responsibility of looking out for his young daughter. And if she makes a silly vow, he can annul the vow. So this is the point that's being made over here. That the daughter, who was really an extension of the father, and the father felt responsible for her, that's why this terrible disaster came about specifically through the daughter. It was more offensive for the Caesar because it was his daughter. Had it been his son, he would have expected his son to fend for himself. But when it was his daughter, he felt that this was a personal attack. Anyway, that's what the Maharal says. So why is it that Tur Malka gets destroyed by virtue of a rooster and a hen. And Beitar gets destroyed by virtue of side of a carriage. There's got to be a symbolism there, right? So there was, and remember, they're both geography. Beitar was a huge megacity, and Turmalka is an enormous province. So it's not like the Beis HaMikdash. Both of these stories, one is the time of the second Beis HaMikdash, one is the time of Beitar. But both of these stories are talking about a certain geography. So what's the symbolism? One geography got identified with the rooster and the hen, and the other geography got identified with a cedar tree and the side of a wagon. Because Tur Malka was a place that was famous for, more than anything else, population. Not so righteous, not so good, but enormous population. And therefore, in order to destroy them, you needed an enormous fighting force. And we heard about an enormous fighting force. A crazy amount of soldiers, of swordsmen. What was Beitar, however? Beitar did not have so many people. It was not quantity. But Beitar was a very difficult city to capture. Why? Because of the strength and the quality of the people who lived there. I'm not talking about spiritual quality. I'm talking about they had a qualitative advantage, militarily speaking. And Beitar was a very powerful city. And therefore, the Erez, what does the chicken and hen rooster and hen represent?
Reproduction.
Rapid reproduction.
Fecundity.
If you say so. You'll tell me what that word means later. Reb Nachum, the day I stop learning, the day I stop living, right? I have to learn. Tell me what fecundity means. Anyway, Beitar was not known for fecundity. I hope I'm using that right. Beitar was known for stamina, for courage, for strength, military prowess. And therefore, we say they were chazokim, strong. What's the symbolism of strength? The Erez, the cedar tree, the toughest wood, the tall, mighty wood. And this was the idea of the chazek, the strength of the area of Beitar. And therefore was destroyed through the daughter of the Caesar, which is symbolic of the strength, so to speak. Why? Because the Targum of daughter, which is Bat in Aramaic, is Banat. Banat is the same word of building and the same word of a house. So actually, what's being conveyed to us is that when it comes to the strength of the Jewish people, who is the stronger gender? Who is the strength of the Jewish people? The strength of the Jewish people is their women, not the men. The quality of the Jewish people will depend on the woman. And we know that if there are righteous Jewish women, there will be a righteous Jewish generation. If Rachman al-Itzlan, there's no righteous Jewish woman, no matter how righteous the men will be, there will not be a future, there will not be a tomorrow. And that's why, of course, we know Moshe Rabbeinu, when he was sent by God to convey the message of Torah to the Jewish people, who did he speak to first? He spoke to the women first. Beis Yaakov, because it comes to quality, when it comes to strength, not brute strength, not physical stamina and strength, when it comes to the quality of strength, when it comes to the house of Israel. So here we have a face-off of house, of strength. And that was the face-off of Roman strength. The Romans had the same idea. They also wanted strong women. They also wanted a strong tomorrow. So this is the facing off of quality or of power. Whereas the Turmalka was a facing off of continuity, of children. So what happened? What happened was the daughter of the Caesar was riding through town. And Itbar Shoka the Rispak. The door of this little wagon, this feminine little wagon that she would ride, it broke. So what did the soldiers who accompanied her do? Katsu Arza, Bailula. They went and chopped down a tree to fashion lumber to fix the door. What happened? So the Jewish people saw the tree of their son being cut down. What did they think? They're trying to undermine our strength. This is symbolic. This is symbolic. They're saying when our daughter, when the Caesar's daughter needs strength, needs protection, she'll chop down your strength in order for her to be strong. So to them, this was very ominous and was very, very deep and rich in symbolism, very concerning for them. And so they attacked. Asu nafalayo machanu. The Jewish people came, and they attacked this camp. They thought that the Jewish people, and its emphasis here specifically, the Marsha says, it was a male cedar, not a female cedar. They thought we're trying to undermine our strength. The Roman daughters will take away the strength of the Jewish men. Chop down the tree, and that's how that will be the, so to speak, that will protect them. And this concerned them very much. And they said, aha, this said the Marsha is reminiscent of the Pharaoh. What did the Pharaoh seek to do?
Kill the boys.
And what is he going to do with the girls?
Marry
them to Egyptians, and then they would be fully assimilated. He said, you see what they're trying to do? They're trying to break the males, the Jewish males, and then the Jewish females, they'll marry off the Roman soldiers, and this will be the end of our people. So therefore, they felt they couldn't sit by quietly, and they attacked. Obviously, if these people would have known the end result of attacking a group of soldiers over a rooster and a hen, or over a piece of lumber, I'm sure they wouldn't have done it. But, you know, hindsight, as they say, is 20/20. When you're in the thick of things, you're in the thick of things. You're in the fog of the moment. You have to deal with the fog of the moment. And so what happened here? So also Alayu Machanu, the Jewish people came and they smote them. Also Amr Lil Caesar, they came and they said to the Caesar, Mordu Bach Yehudoi, the Jews are rebelling. They start up with your daughter. Caesar heard they started up with his daughter. He saw red, flew into a rage. Also Alayu. And so he mounted a full attack, mobilized his forces, and they came to Beitar. The Gemara now tells a story, or gives a drasha actually, expounds, offers us a homily on the pasuk that's found, the third pasuk that's found in the second chapter of Eicha. Previously we expounded the second pasuk in the second chapter of Eicha. Now we're expounding the third pasuk in the second chapter of Eicha. What does the pasuk say? Goda bechari af koil keren Yisrael. God uprooted in fury the entire pride of Israel. Keren means literally a horn, but it's a yorim keren meshicha. It's the idea of a pride, of raising up. So what does this mean? Omar Rabbi Zeira taught in the name of Rabbi Avohu, who taught this in the name of the elder sage of the Jerusalem Talmud, Rabbi Yochanan. Elu shmoinim elef karne milchamam. These are the 80 or 80,000 bugles of war, for trumpets of war, which really refers not to a trumpet, because what's the big deal? Would you kill a trumpet? A trumpet meant represented a leader, a general, one who could mobilize, one who could give forth a call and gather the troops. So these were the heads of troops, or lieutenants, or majors, battalion heads, whatever it was. And how would they get the people to come together? By virtue of a trumpet, a bugle. Why would they do it that way? So first of all, let me remind you that Moshe Rabbeinu was given trumpets. What did he do with the trumpets? He would unite the leadership, get the people to come together. So it's very interesting. The Balei HaTosfos say that, you know why Moshe Rabbeinu, on a very simple level, you know why he used the trumpet? He said, because otherwise there would be politics. Which one of the tribes, leaders of the tribes, did he call first? Who got called first? Who got called second? It would always be an endless politics. Therefore, what did he do? He sent out a uniform text message to everybody. He blew the trumpet. They heard the trumpet, this in a specific tone, the ringtone of the trumpet. They knew, okay, we have to come now. So if you want to mobilize the soldiers, the best way to do it is you avoid any kind of politics. You keep everybody in an even keel. You blow the bugle, then they'll have to come. Besides, it's a very practical way. Since there was no text messaging yet then, a very simple thing. The general blows his bugle, everybody knows they have to show up. Pashat. The Ben Yehuda says that part of the drasha on these words, it says, Bechari af. What's af? The word af can be an acronym for pei elef, 80,000. And that's how he follows the girsa. There's two girsars, there's two versions of the Gemara, whether it was shmoinim, 80 generals, or 80,000. He says, since the drasha is on the words Bechari af, so the Ben Yehuda says that the af is pei elef. That's what it stands for. So what happened? So there was all these were the commanders. You could imagine if there were so many commanders, what kind of troops they were able to command and muster. Shenichnesu lekrach beitar, b'shah shelechadua, that they finally breached the walls and entered the municipality of Beitar when they captured it. Vaharguba, and they mass murdered anoshim, v'noshim v'taf, men, women, and children. So much so, so intense were the massacres, so great were the numbers, Achaholach Domon Vinofalayama Godol. A river of blood flowed from Beitar. From Beitar to the Mediterranean Sea. Now we know where Beitar is today. There's a large settlement built in Beitar today. The world calls it a settlement, verstehst? A settlement. Here you're reading about the story of Beitar, and it has the same name, and they call it a settlement. Sugar. Anyway, we know where Beitar is. We have the archaeological evidence of Beitar. So they slaughtered so many people in Beitar that there went a river of blood flowed into the Mediterranean. And the Gemara knows it's talking to people who may not have seen Eretz Yisrael ever in their lives, and they didn't see a map, and they wouldn't see a picture. Shema Taimer, lest you think, Kreivaisa, you think that Beitar is close to the Mediterranean Sea, so therefore it was a coastal city, and there was a massacre, and the blood flowed. No. Rechaikahaisa. Beitar is not close to the coast. It is not close to the Mediterranean Sea. And the Gemara says it was mil, at least a farsang away from the sea. I think the Beitar we know of is significantly more than a farsang from the sea. But at any rate, the point here is that it was not a close thing. And so literally, for a river to have that kind of stamina, that kind of cadence, to be able to flow for a farsang for 2.3 kilometers or something like that, until a river flows into the sea, you're talking about the murder of millions of people. Millions of people. There's no other way to understand it. So what happened? They wanted to plant themselves with strength, right? They planted these Erez trees, and they wanted to show how strong they were. And what happened in the end? In the end, they were uprooted entirely, to the point that their blood flowed into the water. And what was left of the blood? What was left even of their blood? Nothing, because it was lost in the great sea, the Mediterranean Sea. In other words, there was not even a zecher, not even a remembrance left of them. Maharal says that's the kind of the parallel here. What was the problem, incidentally, with the people of Beitar? What was the problem of Bar Kokhba? Say Mishua's Bar Duraima. He said, we don't need God. We can do this by ourselves. We the people, we the mighty, we the brave, we the courageous, we the pious, I don't know. We the reverent, maybe not. We don't have to be great believers. We, self-determination, we can do this all by ourselves. And Nebach, that's what they planted, the Arozim, and they wanted a symbol of strength, the Erez tree, symbol of their strength. And Nebach, where did they end up? Nothing was left. Even the blood ends up in the water, and we know that it becomes battle. It becomes overwhelmed. There's nothing left. And this is the tragedy of the people of Beitar. The Gemara goes further and says, Tanya, Rabbi Eliezer HaGadol Eimer, Rabbi Eliezer the Great said, Shnei Necholim Yesh Bebikas Yodayim. There are two gorges, or streams, that go through an area called the Valley of Yodayim. Echad Moshech, one sends its waters, Eilech, in one direction. Ve'echad Moshech Eilech, You have rivers flowing in the same gorge, in the same valley, and they flow different directions. And he says, you should know when the people of Beta were killed and the blood was spilled, that both these rivers, can't be two rivers because they're going in different directions, both rivers were flowing with blood. V'shiru chachamim, our sages, by analyzing the consistency of the water, they said, shnei chalakim mayim, that this water was two parts water, ve'echad dam, and one part blood, one third blood. This was how bad the carnage, the massacre was. Now, mayim is what we call a koyach chumri. It's almost like liquid is not solid. It's not, the molecular structure of liquid is different. And the nature of water also is that water doesn't have a property of its own. Water is clear. So water can assume different properties, but in and of itself, it doesn't have a property. People say the ocean is blue. It's not true. The ocean is not blue. What color is the ocean? It's actually clear. Why does it look blue to us? Because it reflects the sky, exactly. And therefore, water really has no color. And this represents the idea of what we call choymer blitzura. You have density, you have physical mass, but it doesn't have any form. Water is what we call amorphous. It doesn't have a form. Any water assumes the form of wherever it's being held. And water doesn't have any color. And what we see here is that the water was more than blood, right? Two parts water, one part blood. However, the koyach of the chaymer was able to overwhelm the tzura. So we say there's this idea of hagbaras hatzura al hachaymer. Real strength is when form can take mastery over matter. So for example, to control yourself. For example, to take a situation, to harness a situation. It means you take matter, and you master it. Make it in your own image, so to speak. A person has to toil on having hagbaras hatzura al hachaymer, that the finer elements of life should be dominant over flesh, over mass, over matter. And here, the water, which is basically the simplest form of matter, overwhelmed the blood, which is the most profound form of liquid form. Now, the blood types is identifiable. Blood is DNA in it. There's no liquid that's more sophisticated than blood. The most sophisticated liquid in the world, the greatest tzura in any liquid, is the concept of dam, of plasma. And yet, what we saw was a hakbaras hachaymer al tzura, despite the fact that they had the quality of people, and despite the fact they were such great warriors, and despite the fact that they're such impressive people, and they had so much tzura, they had so much personality, which is the emphasis in this city of not of numbers like Turmalka, but rather quality over the idea of quantity. Nonetheless, in the end, the Ben Yehuda says the overwhelming nature of the carnage was such that they were totally eclipsed. That even the simplest form of matter was able to eclipse and override this most sophisticated form of liquid, which is plasma or blood. So nothing was left of them. The Gemara finishes off by telling us the Masnita Tana, we learned in the Mishnah, in the Braisa, Sheva Shonim Batsru, Evdi Gechavim Es Karmeim, that the few idolaters, non-Jews who are living in the area, we know Romans moved people into the area, living in Elias Capitolina and elsewhere. So the Hadrian moved people, foreign people in and renamed. This is when it gets renamed Palestina, to make fun of the Jewish people, created a fake name. So at that time, the idolaters living in the area, they were able to fertilize their vineyards for 7 years, below Zevel, without using any dung. Dung was once a commodity. And they were able to use the blood of the carnage of the people, the plasma left over from the murder of the Jewish people, and in such a horrific way that for 7 years it was the blood of the Jewish people that fertilized the land around Beitar that was being used afterwards for farming. And this gives us a little bit of a glimpse, a picture of the awful carnage that took place and the symbolism that was behind it. And with this, we shall conclude.